Good day, and welcome to the Mutual Fund Observer Conversation with Bernie Horn of Polaris Capital Conference Call. All participants will be in a listen-only mode. Should you need assistance, please signal a conference specialist by pressing the star key followed by zero. After today's presentation, there will be an opportunity to ask questions. Please note that this event is being recorded. I would now like to turn the conference over to Mr. David Snowball. Please go ahead.
Great. Thank you, Dan, and welcome, everyone. As Dan said, I'm Dave Snowball. I'm publisher of the Mutual Fund Observer, and I'm very pleased to welcome you to the Observer's Conversation with Bernie Horn, founder and president of Polaris Capital Management. We'll begin as we generally do with the obvious. Our conviction is that about 80% of all mutual funds could shut their doors today, and they would not be missed. Many are large, unimaginative asset sponges, which neither their managers nor their trustees would invest in. Those of us who have served on investment committees know the story. The investment committees don't look for funds that will excel. They look for funds that the committee can't be criticized for picking. Those funds thrive by never being bad enough to dump, and so year after year, their numbers swell. By one recent estimate, a third of all mutual fund money is invested in closet index funds, nominally active funds whose strategy and portfolio are barely distinguishable from an index. About a third of all money is invested in passive products, and only that final third in funds that are actually active. Sadly, the behemoths are the funds that win analyst coverage and investor attention. The Observer writes for the benefit of intellectually curious, serious investors, managers, advisors, and individuals who need to go beyond marketing fluff, beyond computer-generated recommendations, and beyond Morningstar's coverage universe. We believe that Mr. Horn and the good folks at Polaris have demonstrated that they don't belong to the herd, and we suspect never will. Mr. Horn and the Polaris team advise Polaris Global Value and sub-advise several very fine funds for Peartree and for PNC. Our plan is to devote the first third of our hour together to an introduction to the fund, the middle third to my questions, and the final third to your questions. As we approach that time, Dan will remind you of how to get in the queue, speak directly with Mr. Horn. So, welcome, sir. I hope you're having a good evening.
Yeah. Good evening, David. Thanks for having me.
Entirely reasonable people, famously Jack Bogle, but also folks like Bill Snead at Snead Value, argue that there's no systemic gain to investing beyond the U.S., that American corporations are among the world's most innovative, they represent some preeminent brands, they reach into every corner of the world, operate in a very rigorous regulatory framework. And it seems to me that opinion was certainly more common in 1980 when you began managing global portfolios, or even 10 years later when you launched Polaris. I was wondering if, at the outset, sir, could you tell us a bit about why you launched a global fund or a global portfolio and how you approach the work of putting that portfolio together?
Sure. The genesis of the idea really went back when I was at the Sloan School at MIT, where at the time, efficient market theories and passive strategies were really coming out of the textbooks and being implemented in some cases for the first time. And so in my view, when I was sitting in 1980 looking back over the 70s, it became pretty obvious because the U.S. market had flatlined, certainly in real terms, for about 10 years, partly due to the fact that we had this oil crisis. But if you looked around the world, you also saw there were some countries that were oil producers who actually did quite well in the 70s. Notwithstanding that simple observation, but the work of people like Bruno Solnit, who at the time was starting to publish about the benefits of international diversification, all kind of caught my eye. And one of my professors, Fisher Black, who was very fond of talking about efficient market hypothesis, also had his handy little list of exceptions to market efficiency, one of which was value investing. So being a thrifty New Englander, I felt that the a logical place to go for starting up a firm, which I decided to do out of the Sloan School, was to decide to invest around the world where I could find countries or or single stocks that had very low correlation to U.S. economic kind of systematic risk, and also had the potential for, you know, decent gains. And so that was really the genesis of the idea. And the first company that I started, Horn & Company, in 1980, soon started to collect separately managed individual accounts that were diversified globally. And that became a bit of an administrative challenge because many of the custodians who were safekeeping the securities for our clients often would miss a dividend and would spend more time chasing around dividends than we would many other the things that we wanted to do. So ultimately, we asked some of those clients if they would pool their funds or their accounts into a limited partnership, which we started in 1989, and that really is what generated the long-term history of the Polaris Global Value Fund. So we ran it as a limited partnership from 1989 to 1998 when it became a public mutual fund. So the basic philosophy is to take this value investing, apply it globally, and try to construct portfolios that have effectively lower risk than certainly the U.S. market. But as it's evolved, we tried to create a lower risk portfolio than the overall benchmark, which would be the world benchmark, and just do that by buying really low cost, good value stocks. So that's kind of the quick history of the fund.
Okay. So do you want to talk to us a bit about how you do that? Like, what are you looking for?
Sure. I mean,
the fund together?
Yeah, what distinguishes Polaris from some of our competitors is that we, you know, this whole concept, as I was just referring to, this give and take between active management and passive management is one where, you know, we really don't think that we belong in business, quite frankly, unless we can beat the benchmark. And that's the job, obviously, of active managers, as you referred to in your opening remarks. And one of the ways that we kind of simplified this problem is that we said, look, if we can buy a portfolio of, let's say, 75 companies, and if each one of those companies is priced to essentially beat the long-term benchmark returns of, let's say, it's about 6% after inflation, and if we have a good batting average and we can pick 75 companies that are all priced to beat the benchmark, then theoretically we should beat the benchmark. It sounds like a pretty simple concept, and it is in general, but it's very difficult to execute because markets are going up and down, and markets, quite frankly, are still pretty efficient. So our whole philosophy is based on the premise that we shouldn't make an investment in a company unless it's priced to beat the benchmark. And we define that pretty carefully by saying that if the benchmark return is 6% after inflation, and the top quartile managers who consistently beat benchmarks over long periods of time do so by making at least 2% above that, then our cost of capital, or what we call our Polaris global cost of equity, is that 6% plus 2%. And then because we're investing around the world, we have to worry about exchange rate risk. We adopted some years ago this idea that the fixed income markets are pretty efficient arbitrageurs of interest rates, inflation rates across countries, and the effective real rates of interest on longer term or even money market funds embed in the real rates the potential foreign exchange rate risk. So if you look around the world today, you'll see that in Argentina you have a 24% or so nominal return on the 10-year. They've got about 10% inflation, leaving about a 14% real return. And the reason that you can get a 14% real return in Argentina and only about a 1 or 2% return in U.S. Treasury 10 years is because the fixed income markets are telling us that you're probably going to get a devaluation between the peso and the dollar at some point, and fixed income investors want to be compensated for that. So we basically take that real return and add it to our first two components of our required rate of return. And in this particular case with Argentina, we'd say we want at least 6 plus our 2% alpha plus another 14%, and that kind of gives you our total cost of capital. So about 22% in the case of Argentina. And of course, that changes from country to country. So again, Polaris is distinguished from our competitors because we take this cost of capital pretty seriously, and we only invest in companies that will meet that criteria. So that's our that's kind of, if you want to call it a kind of secret to success, easier said than done. And I think, as you also pointed out in your opening remarks, the bigger you get, the more difficult it is to adhere to this strict value discipline. So that's really the kind of jumping off point that we use to set the bar for what has to go into the portfolio.
Mm-hmm. Could you help us understand a bit, or me understand a bit more about what the cost of capital notion translates to in terms of what you then expect from an investment? That is, if you have an investment in an Argentine firm with 22% cost of capital, what does that mean in terms of your expectations about that firm, or what you would need to believe about that firm?
Yeah. Okay. So it's nice to be able to say this is our cost of capital, but you're correct in pointing out that we have to actually translate that into something that we can work with to buy a company. When we look at companies, we think of them strictly as a stream of cash flow, because effectively all investments, or the value of all investments, ultimately is derived from what the future cash flow stream is in present value terms. So, it's simply a page out of the Finance 101 textbook. So we look at companies as streams of cash flow, and when we examine, that does a number of things for us. The first is that we can compare a software company against a steel or an aluminum company, both of which, have very different capital structures, very different profit and loss statements, and so forth. But if we look at them simply as stream of cash flows, we really don't care, we want to be as agnostic as absolutely possible as to where the most undervalued companies in the world are. So by looking at cash flows as opposed to net profits, that gives us one leg up. And the other thing it does for us is it grounds us in a kind of asset allocation reality, so that if we know, let's say, that the 10-year government in a particular country is going to give us a certain stream of interest payments followed by a principal payment that's effectively government guaranteed, and we can discount that stream of cash flow to the present and compare it to the price of the bond, we know what our yield to maturity is. Well, we think of the company as basically a similar, is very analogous to that. So we can, in effect, lowball our estimates of future cash flow on this company. And we do so for a number of reasons, because, first of all, we want to be conservative and we don't want to really pay for growth. So if we are very conservative about what we think this company can generate in terms of future cash flow, we can then discount that to the present, compare it to the value of the firm, and determine what our expected return is out of that. And if that return is not better than, let's say, the 10-year, then that's not a good investment, right? Because if you can get a better return in a risk-free investment than you can in an equity, that's not good. So if we were to do that, we would sort of blow up people's asset allocation models that would be invested in our fund. So what we try to do is only look for companies that are, A, throwing off a sustainable level of cash flow that is relatively predictable, or at least where we can conservatively estimate at least what the company should be able to do. And if it does better than that, that's terrific, because that effectively gives us a lot more alpha. So that's kind of what we do at Polaris in very simple terms. We screen a very large universe of companies for those that are priced to give us that Polaris Capital Global cost of equity. And then we roll up our sleeves and do a lot of financial fundamental analysis, looking at the P&L, the balance sheet, the cash flows, and estimate those going forward. in such a way that we think it's a relatively conservative look at the company. And if it's priced so that we buy that cash flow to meet our required rate of return, and that required rate of return essentially helps us beat the benchmark, then we've kind of done a good job for the clients. And that's kind of how we think of our job. And over, you know, basically a 30-year period, this discipline has worked such that we've been able to generate about 200 basis points of excess return in absolute terms over the market. And we've been able to do that where that pattern of returns, if you look at the beta of that relative to the benchmark, it's actually lower as well. It's that, you know, that beta will drift up and down over time. And on a 3 and 5 year basis, if you're looking at our numbers, they will jump around even more. But we look at the long-term inception to date record when we're measuring our risk relative to the benchmark. So that's mm-hmm. kind of it in very simple terms.
Mm-hmm. And so how do you then construct a portfolio? So you've got a number of those companies. Do you have a target size of the portfolio, a number of companies?
Yeah. So again, this is where the bottom-up methodology that we use comes into play. So we definitely, I said a bit earlier that we want to be really agnostic about where these values are coming from. You know, value managers and portfolio managers in general will, you know, given no other motivation, you know, tend to hug the benchmark because that's what their bonuses are based on. But we really don't think that we can add, we cannot hug the benchmark and apply this discipline because it just won't work. So what we do is we apply the rate of return requirement to the universe, and out of that falls a whole bunch of companies in different industries all around the world. And so our job is really to just follow these screens and understand kind of where they're coming from. The portfolio will then be composed over time of what the screens are giving us, assuming that they all pass our kind of fundamental analysis look at the world. And when we construct a portfolio, we try to mix the number of securities into the portfolio together in such a way that we're not taking, you know, overly large bets in one particular sector or country, because we know that an individual stock price return is still composed of about two-thirds country industry factors and one-third individual stock fundamentals. So we're pretty careful that when we do have a value sector, for instance, right now we have without a doubt the largest sector coming through our screens are financials. Virtually every country that we look at, the financials are kind of rock bottom in terms of valuation. And, you know, we could construct a portfolio of 100% financials. Of course, we wouldn't want to do that because if something goes wrong and we have another financial crisis or something, then we would have, you know, just huge downside volatility. So what we try to do is whenever we have new stocks in our screen that we're looking at investing in, we're always on the lookout for something new that has a very low correlation to what we already own. And by doing this over time, we've been able to build portfolios that, without a doubt, first and foremost, are great values that can beat the benchmark, but also structured in a way that if we do have a big value sector like financials, we really try to narrow it down so that we're only buying the absolute best either in quality or value in that sector. And rather than going, you know, really overweight something that's not going to be, you know, that's going to be perhaps too exposed. And likewise, if we do find ourselves investing in a particular kind of factor bet, let's say it's related to interest rates or something, we tend to be very well aware of that simply because we're doing such detailed fundamental analysis on the companies and we get to know the management teams and the businesses quite well that by doing that, we kind of know even, I think, better than an optimization model could help us just really what are the drivers of the cash flow of that company. So we're always trying to build a portfolio such that if you were to, let's say, buy, let's suppose we had a portfolio of 75 companies, which is generally speaking our target, if you were to merge all 75 companies together to form one huge conglomerate, mm-hmm. we would want the kind of pattern of future cash flows from that conglomerate to be kind of very minimum variance cash flows. And if we can do that, then presumably the volatility of the whole portfolio will be more moderate as well than, let's say, something that might be a value-weighted index that could be overly influenced by those big weights in the index, if you will.
Okay, not to be trendy, but if your portfolio were to be considered as a company, then you'd be looking for companies that would be called resilient. That is, a spike in the interest rates wouldn't particularly, while it might disrupt some of the divisions of the company, the firm's cash flow overall wouldn't be impaired. Is that the thought?
Yeah, it's very much the kind of thing that we are looking for. So sustainability of the cash flow throughout the market cycle for the companies that we invest in, that's something that we really focus on pretty carefully. Mm-hmm. That doesn't mean that we won't have the company from time to time that that does get hurt in a downturn, because every company, depending on what their sector is going to get, is going to, be exposed to certain cyclical elements. And when they do, they're going to get affected. But our job is to mix those companies up in such a way that if something is doing poorly, then something else could be offsetting that because it's maybe positively affected by that movement. I mean, for instance, if you look at our energy holdings right now, we have a couple of E&P companies, but then we also have some refining companies that are actually benefiting from the fact that crude oil prices are down and actually refining margins have ticked up a little bit. So again, we're trying to, even though we have that exposure to energy, we're trying to do it in such a way that gives us less variance, but also sustainability of long-term cash flows. The other hallmark of companies that we like to look for is that they might have, let's say, a service business that will continue to generate cash flow even if, let's say, the new equipment business dries up for a little bit, or that the company that we're investing in has a really low position in the industry cost curve, so that even if things get a little bit dicey, like we're seeing in the materials and energy sector today, if we're invested in a company that's at the bottom end of the cost curve, they can be far more resilient than the companies that are going out of business at the top end of the cost curve. So yeah, I mean, we look for this sustainability and resilience as much as we possibly can in all the companies that we put into the portfolio.
Mm-hmm. I guess I'd be remiss if we didn't talk a bit about the meltdown in 07 and 08, at least in relative terms. The fund melted rather more than most of its competitors. And I didn't know if you could help me understand a couple things, what went wrong, and how you've thought about it in the years since. Is there a fundamental change that you needed to make in order to account for the experience you had then?
Yeah, it's a bit difficult to explain because we thought we were doing so many of the same things that we did in the dot-com bubble, where we were extraordinarily resilient to the downturn. And in some ways, we had a not too dissimilar portfolio in some respects. So we had companies that we thought were generating good value, that they were priced as good value, they were generating good, strong business models that were resilient even if we did get a downturn. But I would say that, the things that we had greater exposure to in hindsight that we could have gone into it with less would be our materials holdings, our financials, some of the home builders, and even, so these are the companies that when even though they were the valuations on these firms held up quite late into the kind of meltdown. It was only post the Lehman bankruptcy when investors became so concerned about liquidity and just even the ability to get cash out of mutual funds, when that became the highest concern that people had, and they were basically having a run on mutual funds because they were concerned about that level of risk being very, very high. The companies in our materials, financials, consumer discretionary sectors just got hammered, and effectively there was really no place to hide. What we've done since then is to try to, in every way possible, further diversify away from some of those cyclical sectors. And we've found, a variety of companies that we think are good low correlation assets to those sectors as well. We've done a lot of things in terms of stress testing our financial models on companies, paying a little bit more attention to the serviceability of debt. I think at the top of the 07-08 cycle, we had some companies that had engaged in some mergers for the right reasons. They did good deals, but they took on a little debt to take on those things so that they didn't dilute shareholders so much. But when the credit cycle turned, it really hurt them, very much. And so the bankers tended to be dictating terms as how the in terms of how the companies were managed and so forth. So that hurt the companies. I will say that if we look at the recovery of these companies, so I would say that in the case of companies like Kone, the elevator firm, which traded down 50-60% during the crisis, this is a company that has long-term elevator maintenance contracts. Even some of our British home builders that were down 80-90%, these companies either cut back on the production very rapidly and liquidated their inventory real quick in the case of the home builders. And then in the case of some of our industrial companies like Kone and some of the firms that were dependent on order books, these order books actually held up without cancellation through the really tough part of the downturn. And as those order books were worked off, they generated a lot of cash. It helped the companies to retain their resiliency. And fortunately, the recovery eventually came through such that the orders began to replace those order books that were worked off. So when we looked at the portfolio companies that were down anywhere from 50 to 80-90% during the crisis, the business models that we bought into actually turned out to be as resilient as we thought we bought into them. But in the depths of the crisis, everybody thought they were going to go into bankruptcy, which they never did. So as they came through the cycle, their cash flows didn't become all that impaired. Certainly they went down a little bit, but they recovered nicely. And because they tended to have good, strong cash flows, relatively low levels of debt across the, most of the companies that we owned, they got actually stronger during the downturn. And when everybody's emotional kind of being settled down a little bit, everybody took a fresh, and many investors took a fresh look at these companies and decided that, yes, they weren't going to go out of business. And, oh, by the way, they are getting stronger during the downturn, and they should probably not be trading where they are, and they kind of roared back. And fortunately, we had, enough confidence in the business models that when they were at the depths of the valuation cycle in the first quarter of 09, we were buying more of them as much as we could and kind of averaged down tremendously on the valuations. And now, and then when we did get a recovery, we got tremendous gains back. So when we look at the 07-08 results, which are not, which were the worst of my life, and you follow them by, our 5- and 7-year track record looks reasonably good. But I think that to put this whole thing in context as well, if you look at our long-term global composite and our international composite outside the mutual fund, you'll see that there were 24 years in a row where we were never down more than 10%. And so we had that 1 year out of 25 where we were down more than 10%. It was a bit of a whopper, I'll absolutely admit, and I'm sure I'll be explaining it for the rest of my life. But it was a nasty. It was definitely a nasty time, let me tell you.
Uh-huh. So you've talked about stress testing the firm. What does that translate to? Because there's always that whole, you don't want to fight the last war. And so do you look at the portfolio now and say, what happens if there's another freeze in the financial markets, or what sort of things are you looking at?
Yeah, I think, you know, it's important not to be fighting last year's crisis, because the next crisis, even though history tends to repeat itself in one form or another, you know, it's never going to be the same thing next time as it was that created the problem the last time. So but what we have done, let's say, in our individual fundamental analysis is to, you know, have a much closer look at the breakdown between variable and fixed costs within the businesses that we're running. And looking at the kind of the marginal change in cash flow as it relates to, let's say, fixed costs for various changes in sales. So we'll stress test the company by letting the sales go down 10 or 20% and see what the fixed cost absorption looks like and what will happen to net profits and so forth. So that's one example, and there are a variety of things that we do. And looking at just the ability of the companies to use variable cost structures as opposed to all fixed costs, that tends to help a business retain more longevity through the cycle. But we're analyzing it a lot more carefully. I'd have to say that the kind of companies that we're buying have not changed dramatically, because the characteristics of what we used to buy before 07 and 08 is, you know, they held up reasonably well for us, notwithstanding the decline. But we're really trying to just make sure that we understand them a little bit more. So we add, you know, staff here and there to try to do an ever more thorough job and become even more efficient as we go through the development and the evolution of our investment process and our investment strategy.
Mm-hmm. And so when you kind of changed or made more kind of rigorous the stress test, did you lose anyone from the portfolio?
In the last quarter of 2008, we identified 25 companies in the portfolio that were, I think, more cyclically exposed. We did a lot of stress tests on those 25 financial models, and we basically bumped off about five companies that were kind of a little bit more stressed that we didn't feel comfortable owning at that point. And then it was really the other 20 that we wound up loading back up on. So yeah, we will do that. And I must say that in our current environment, there are several companies that we've been watching for 4 or 5 years, really, that look really good value. We really love the business models. We think that the management teams are doing a great job, but we sort of differ with them on the amount of leverage that they're willing to let the business become exposed to. So we have kind of held back a lot more than we perhaps would have in 07 and 08 when everything looked great. And so there are probably three or four companies that I would absolutely love to buy if we could get the debt level down a little bit more. But really, they're just remaining on our watch list until that happens.
Mm-hmm. Okay. I thought if it was okay with you, I would ask just one more question, maybe two, before we turn things over to the folks who've been listening so politely. Dan, could you take a second there and explain to the folks, if they had a question for Mr. Horn, how they might raise it?
Sure. To ask a question, you may press star, then one on your touch-tone phone. If you are using a speakerphone, please pick up your handset before pressing the keys. To withdraw your question, please press star, then two.
Great. Thank you. And so I was sort of wondering, you run not just the Global Value Fund, but several that are more purely international, several, at least one that has a smaller cap focus. And I didn't know if the other funds, often the ones that you're running for the good folks at Peartree, require a different discipline, or if they're basically just a subset of the same pool of companies you would invest invest with in the Global Value Fund.
Yeah, it's the answer is it's a subset of the whole pool, and the reason for that is because we want to be really focused on this discipline. Nothing is more important to us than making sure that whatever stock we buy is priced to give us that excess return over the benchmark, and that's really what we're all about. And then, you know, it's kind of like Abe Lincoln said that a lawyer's tool in trade is time. And we, you know, there are precious few hours in the day when you're trying to cover 39,000 companies all around the world. And so what we try to do is narrow that down so that we're only looking at companies that are priced, you know, as such. And so what happens in terms of our product portfolio is that we obviously have a global philosophy and a global strategy. And we look at the whole world, we look at companies that are good value, and then it's kind of an afterthought, so to speak, where we form our global portfolio, and then for our non-U.S. portfolios, we sort of take the U.S. out of that, because what we're saying is that what's left over are the best companies in terms of value and quality and sustainability outside the U.S. And then if it also happens to be that we've done some work on a company and then we look at the market cap and it's, you know, less than $2 billion and it kind of hovers on average around $1 billion, then it would be slotted into the small cap fund. So we're trying to make you know, efficient use of our time, and we want to kind of squeeze all the kind of product lines out of what we're doing in terms of our investment process over that time period. So we're really, again, it's the same, very much the same discipline, regardless of what investment vehicle the stocks wind up in.
Okay, but presumably then there's that you have to then repeat the portfolio sort of cross test with the foreign small value fund, where it could be that all of the great small cap companies outside the U.S. are financials, and so you would do the same thing. I'll just take the best of the international financial companies, but you would do the same, presumably, attempt to keep from becoming overexposed to any particular risk factor.
That's absolutely correct. So you're right that we still use the same kind of art and science in the construction of the portfolio, but the bottom-up search for value is still the same regardless. And again, we're trying to be agnostic about where a good value is in the world, which country, which sector, and of course, which size company it is. So we really don't want to bias ourselves in any way in terms of what we set ourselves up, or we don't want to create any biases going into the process. The stock selection and the portfolio construction is kind of a function of the bottom-up research.
Okay. Hey, Dan, do we have any folks on the line?
We do. Our first question comes from the position of Timothy Garr. Please go ahead.
Okay, markets definitely go up, the markets definitely go down, and you guys are doing your due diligence. Wouldn't the next step seem to be to reward shareholders, as well as you guys, with taking concentrated positions in your best ideas, running a more of a non-diversified focus fund than a fund that's basically, from a value point of view, trying to protect more on the downside than rewarding you for all the due diligence you're doing? And the other question, which is something completely different, is with Polaris, you're not, you're a transaction fee fund through the supermarket, such as Fidelity. Is there a reason for that?
Great. Thanks, Tim.
Yeah, so, very good question. This whole, we have spent quite a lot of time, and we've actually worked on some concentrated portfolios to see if we're so smart that we can outsmart our more diversified portfolio. And the fundamental problem with that is that there are times when the smaller mid-cap stocks, which tend to be more inefficiently priced, are better value and contribute more to the returns. And to sort of exclude some of those from an account, from a more concentrated portfolio, can be, can be less productive in terms of the overall return. So what I found over a few decades of doing this is that about 75 companies in the global portfolio and about 50 in the non-U.S. gives us the ability to construct the kind of low correlations among themselves within the portfolio so that we're getting about an optimal balance between excess return and less downside volatility. And to be, if I heard you right, I think you were suggesting that if we were to be able to be more concentrated in the positions that we have, that it would provide us with better downside protection. And I just haven't found that in my experience that that's possible. Now, maybe we're just not smart enough to pick of the 75 companies that we are investing in, maybe we're just not smart enough yet to pick out the best 30, let's say. I will say that there has been a lot of discussion and a lot of new products in the marketplace that are concentrated, and the way those are sold is that the portfolio managers are smart enough to be able to pick their best ideas. And there is a maybe, and I think that there are probably some good, I know there are some great portfolio managers out there that are good at that. I will say, though, that many of these strategies are born out of the fact that if you get too big in this business, you get to the point where you can only buy large cap stocks. And if you want to impose any kind of value discipline on that, you can't buy a lot of large cap stocks and stick to a value discipline. So we are, we're of the view that we can construct better portfolios with better downside protection with slightly more, but not too many more, because then we're going too far down the value. We're kind of not diluting our value principles to some degree. So that's the, I hope that answers your question, but let me, and you feel free to come back if you, if I didn't answer it properly.
Well, the option to that would be to cap the portfolio, cap the size of the portfolio.
Which at some point we might have to do, but we don't have to worry about that right now. I mean, we've probably got, $4 or $5 billion more under management before we have to start worrying about some of those things. But yeah, you're right that I think that is a strategy, and that's something that we'll deal with when we get there. The question you had about transaction fees, the Pear Tree funds and the PNC funds are available on the no transaction fee platforms. The Polaris Global Value Fund is not. The primary reason for that is that, we self-market that fund, and our business model is to be partnering with people who have sales and distribution personnel who can help kind of spread the word about the results that we're getting, and hopefully if we get good results, we get more money to manage. I will say, though, that in order to be able to effectively distribute in the no transaction fee platforms, we really would have to staff up a lot more to have people out there, talking to the advisors and so forth. And we really haven't, we'd rather pick stocks, quite frankly. So we're of the view that if we get good results, that at some point we'll get money under management. And in the meantime, we are of the, we're kind of the vanguard mentality that we want to drive our cost structure down as low as possible, because anything that we spend on distribution or transaction fee platforms are simply going to cost investors more. And so our hope is that we we can attract larger amounts of money who aren't, you know, aren't as where the initial commission on the transaction charge is not going to be, you know, an impediment. Now, for that, we give up perhaps some of the 401k money, the daily, you know, in and outs where investors want to be trading in and out of the fund, or they want to do it with small amounts of money, and that's a that is an issue. But we do have a remarkable number of clients who put in, you know, they invest directly in the fund, and they have deductions from their paychecks or checking accounts, and that does not get subject to any transaction fees if they invest directly to the fund. So that's another way that people get around it.
Well, as an independent advisor, I applaud what you do with the Polaris Fund, and I'm concerned that being a sub-advisor to Pear Tree is going to divert from what you're trying to do with Polaris.
Not really. I mean, the Pear Tree folks have been remarkably terrific clients, and I think that there is a clear market out there for the no transaction fee platforms. I'm just saying that we don't have the ability, the staffing internally, to be able to address that. But they definitely do, and it's really helped us to grow. And it, you know, because we're growing, we don't have to worry so much about the marketing and sales function, so we can pick. And hopefully, we can spend more time doing research and picking good stocks and getting good returns.
Well, continue doing your good work and trust the trust.
Thank you. Appreciate that.
Hey, Dan, are there other folks?
There is. The next question comes from the position of Neil Burns. Please go ahead.
Bernie, it's Neil Burns. I hope you and your family are doing well. I heard what you told me about the individual stock analysis. I did get comfort in that. Can you give me a little bit more on what you do for the consolidated risk portfolio, i.e. how you manage country risk, emerging markets, the mix in small, medium, and large cap, and how you decide to choose quantitative and qualitative issues, i.e. what happens to your cash flows with the mergers and acquisitions or in times when the company's structure changes?
Yeah, a lot of certainly a lot of questions embedded in your points, which are all very good, by the way. So, the way we kind of deal with the risks and the is really through the portfolio construction process, where we're trying to make sure that as I said earlier, when we're not really trying to address in any macro way, let's say the economic risks or the macro risks for a particular country or a particular sector. I mean, we're very, very well aware of them because when we meet with, you know, several hundred companies a year, we ask them, hey, how's business? And we get answers. And then we go from sector to sector and country to country, and we travel to all these places, and we get a pretty good handle on what's happening there. So to some degree, we're not quantitatively trying to manage those risks by saying, you know, that we don't want to be in a particular country and so forth, but we're doing it in a qualitative way and trying to make sure that if we are quite nervous about what's going on in a country, we don't want to get in front of a big freight train that's going to come crashing down the rail tracks, if you will. So I don't really think that we're that so we don't try to do it so much quantitatively, but we do tend to build things into our financial models on companies and stress test them so that we understand what the potential downside risk is, and we try to minimize that. And then you also make a point in which, and this M&A, as companies buy and sell divisions, as they restructure their divisions, it becomes ever more challenging to us as analysts to try to analyze companies over, let's say, a time series. I don't think there are not many companies that go through these things where we don't have some difficulties in restructuring our financial statements and our analysis so that we kind of try to best pick apart what's going on at the company. And, you know, one of the signals that sometimes we get from companies is if they're constantly, you know, if every two or three years they're reshuffling the decks and moving this division to another one, and you can't really ever get a good handle on what the company's true profitability is, that tells us something about what the management is doing. And at some point, We may or may not feel comfortable with that management team if we think that they're, if it's a sort of a shell game with, trying to figure out where the P is underneath the three shells, moving around the deck. So, and I will say something that's probably the most important about all of this is that all of my money is invested in the funds that we run. And every person at the firm and the investment staff has most, if not all of their money invested in the funds that we're running. So I can sit here all night long and talk about how, we're very careful. We do terrific fundamental analysis and we, traveling around the world looking at country and so forth. But at the end of the day, if I don't feel comfortable putting my money behind that management team, I'm not going to do it because I don't like to lose my money. I hate losing money, and I know everybody else does too. So fundamentally, there's that, I don't know what you call it, a gut check or a qualitative aspect to the whole investment process that kicks in so that we're all kind of on the same side as our shareholders. We are shareholders.
Great. Dan, are there other questions on in the queue?
There is. The next question comes from the position of Ken Norman. Please go ahead.
Good evening. Thank you for your time. My two questions relate to the foreign value funds. Looking at the large cap, small cap, if you were risk adverse, what percent would you have in each? Or if you were towards the riskier side, how much would you feel comfortable with, say, 80-20 if you're risk adverse, large to small? And then my second question is, are you the lead manager on both of the foreign value funds? Thank you.
Okay, yeah. On the how would I allocate, of course, that's a really tough question, but I'll try to be I won't dodge it, let's put it that way. I think, though, that if you look at the volatility, and I think this is changing. I mean, in the early part of my career, we could invest in small cap companies that nobody cared about, nobody covered them. The people who did invest in them tended to know the businesses reasonably well. And in a crisis, those people tended not to panic and sell when things got dicey. And so you could actually get reasonably good downside protection in small cap companies. That seems to have changed. Because of the advent of all these ETFs, you have a sub-ETF on every index in the world right now, and the risk-on, risk-off behavior of the investors in ETFs, I think, has introduced a little bit more volatility into the small cap. So I would say that, in general, the small cap fund is going to have a little bit more exposure to emerging markets because that's effectively where most of the small caps, about 35% of the small caps in the world are in emerging markets. So if you put small cap and emerging markets together, in theory, you're going to have a little bit more volatility. And of course, we try to do that, to try to manage that as much as possible. The early days of the small cap fund did see a little bit more volatility, but it did get started in May of 08, which was obviously not great timing for in terms of downside volatility. But since then, it's actually done a reasonably good job, and we've focused quite a lot of time trying to manage the beta of that fund down. And I think, if you look at the 3- and 5-year number on it, it's starting to bend back to the way we would like to see it. So, again, I would probably go not too dissimilar to your strategy. Of course, there is a fair amount of – we also do quite a lot to try to make the correlation between those two funds as low as we can get them. And you'll see that we do a little bit more – in terms of buying slightly higher weights of defensive companies in the small cap fund than we do in the large cap or the multi cap, I should say. It's not a large cap, it's very much a multi cap. Okay, so I think that tries to address your question. So I would say, 75, 25 if you're really, conservative, understanding that by buying the two of them, you are getting some better diversification as well. As far as who's managing the fund, so yes, I am the lead manager on the both funds in the prospectus. As far as, we got a call sort of on the, not a call, but a question on the blog about, what are the incentives for Polaris people to, stay here and work. And so what I've done on the small cap fund is to try to let the rest of the team do a lot more of the, you know, the final stock picking and so forth on that. And it also helps us to build a good transition team should anything happen to me over the either suddenly or over the long term. So in effect, it also demonstrates that without my absolute and total involvement in the fund, that, and its track record has, over the 6+ years that it's been in inception, has done, you know, a remarkably good job of being one of the top performing funds. So I think it also demonstrates that not only do we have a great team and very, very smart people, but that the process that I've been describing on this call is reasonably scalable and can be duplicated by, you know, a good, you know, disciplined investment team.
Okay, thank you.
Dan, we might have time for one last question if someone queued up.
At this time, I have no questions in the queue.
Okay, great. You talked, my final questions were sort of about risk here. You had talked about managing down the beta on the small cap fund, and Shostakovich, one of our readers, had asked about, an earlier use of things like options to help manage down volatility. And I didn't know if you could say a bit about how you approach that when you talk about managing the beta down.
Yeah, we have used those. We have used options in the past. We would like to use them more. The problems that we have are that many of the companies in our portfolio simply don't have options traded on them, so it limits our ability. And then the since the 2008 financial crisis, the ability to efficiently use options, even in Europe, has become more impaired because of the margin requirements on some of these, even though we might only be doing a kind of a buy-write strategy.
Mm-hmm.
The other thing is that we don't really want to use options on something that maybe we just bought because we think that the upside is so great that we wouldn't want to be called away in the event the stock got bought out or something. So we really only use them at the point where, A, there's something that is a stock that have options traded on them, and they're getting close to our sell price so that we might generate a little bit of extra income. So it's not really a great way to help us hedge the downside volatility in the stock, because ultimately we really want to be exposed to the substantial upside that we think we have in these long-only positions. As far as the beta that we were talking about, yes, we had sort of a blip up because of the experience we had in 2008, 9, 10, 11, where the portfolio went down more than the market, and then the resilience of these companies meant that the portfolio went way up more than the market. By definition, that's a higher beta strategy. So we did get that kind of working through our results on an inception-to-date basis, and so the beta kind of drifted up. Now, partly it's going down because some of these stocks are reverting back to kind of more of their low beta status, but also we've been trying to work into the portfolio things like Guangdong Investments, which is a water utility in China, and Rexlot, a lottery company in China, and a lottery company in Italy called GTEC. All of these companies tend to be really low correlation, and so the more we can add into the portfolio like that, we think that the better the beta will be over the long term.
Okay, great. And I'm afraid we've come to the end of our hour. And so I'd like to thank Mr. Horn and to you all for your time tonight. A recording of this call and an audio profile of Polaris Global Value will be available at The Observer on February 1st. Highlights and a link to an MP3 will be posted on our discussion board, to which you're all invited, within the next 48 hours. I should also note that we will, in the months ahead, continue offering you the chance to hear from and speak with remarkable managers. In February, we're hopeful of speaking with Ian Mortimer and Matt Page, a London-based team that manages Guinness Atkinson Global Innovators. In March, we'll speak with hedge fund manager and Gotham Partners co-founder David Berkowitz ahead of the launch of his new mutual fund, River Park Focused Value. And in April, we're hopeful of celebrating the third anniversary of Seafarer Overseas Growth and Income with its manager, Andrew Foster. They're all bright, engaging, articulate guys who will do a fine job, but I've got to admit that Mr. Horn tonight set an awfully high standard for them to meet. Good night to you all, and thank you for your patience. And thank you again, Mr. Horn.
Thank you.
The conference has now concluded. Thank you for attending today's presentation. You may now disconnect.